You probably recall the NJ Transit commuter train that crashed into the Hoboken station back in September. The investigation into that crash showed that the train engineer suffered from sleep apnea. That finding has brought much-needed attention to this affliction and has created a call for better policies in order to prevent this tragedy from being repeated. Here to explain what sleep apnea is, who is most likely to have it, and what can result from it, is a sleep specialist with the Center for Sleep and Breathing Disorders at St. Peter's University Hospital, Dr. Douglas Frenier. Thanks for being here today, Doctor.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good to have you here. And it's stpeteruh.com. Learn more about the sleep center and all the facility elements of St. Peter's University Hospital. And I guess the obvious basic question is, Doctor, exactly how is sleep apnea defined?
Well, with sleep apnea, what happens is at nighttime, as the muscles of the throat relax, the airway can actually collapse. And when this happens, the airflow is disturbed. And as a result of this, the patient ends up waking up. And when the patient wakes up from sleep apnea, they end up getting disturbed sleep and therefore end up being tired during the daytime.
And I was doing some reading up, too. It seems like one of the, I mean, not to sound like I'm making a joke or something, how can you tell when something is wrong with your sleeping when you're the one sleeping? But it seems like snoring seems to be a common trait that is probably the most obvious of the warning signs.
Yes. Many times it's the spouse or the partner of the patient that states that the patient has loud snoring. Another common thing we see is when the patient ends up snoring and then their breathing will actually stop for a period of time and then they will snore and wake up again. This is called a witnessed apnea. So we see a lot of times with the patients coming in, their family members are commenting on the disturbed sleep. And then the patient is usually tired as well.
With that respiration stopping and interruption, is there any risk of any fatality from sleep apnea?
Well, it can result in fatality if the events are severe enough. Most of the time what it does is it makes the oxygen in the bloodstream drop, and then the patient wakes up, their airway flow is restored, and then they're able to breathe again. But over the long term, it does have effects on things like blood pressure. Patients that have high blood pressure, it can be more difficult to control when they have these types of events.
You mentioned, too, the after effect for, let's just say someone is on their own and they have this feeling of exhaustion. I mean, it's always dismissed as the mid-afternoon crash, for example, and things like that. But everything about the body, if it feels out of sorts, instead of dismissing it, it really is a warning sign.
Yes, just the tiredness can be a warning sign. We know these patients actually have a higher risk of having car accidents, and we use a screening tool to determine how tired they are. And some of the simple questions in that screening tool involve, do you feel sleepy sitting at a stoplight? Do you feel sleepy during meetings at work and things like that? And by asking those questions, it can help to direct us towards possibly getting the person help.
Are there degrees of sleep apnea, or is it a one-size-describes-all situation?
There's actually degrees. There's mild, moderate, and severe, and it has to do with how many of these events you have per hour. Every hour, if you have greater than five events where your breathing stops, then it's considered sleep apnea, and then there's a scale. Above 30 events is severe, and between 5 and 15 is mild, and between 15 and 30 is moderate range.
Dr. Douglas Frenier, who is a sleep specialist with the Center for Sleep and Breathing Disorders. That's at the St. Peter's University Hospital. St. Peter's UH.com is their website, and you are listening to Issues and Ideas. I mentioned snoring as one of the more obvious symptoms of sleep apnea. Physically, is there something about someone's person, their shape, their health, current state of affairs that makes them more prone to sleep apnea?
Yes, certainly. Obesity is a factor. All patients are not necessarily obese, but obesity is a factor because that causes crowding in the airway, in the area behind the tongue and the soft palate that ends up collapsing during sleep. Also, age is a factor. Male gender is a factor. And even medications which can cause sedation, pain medications and such, can lead to worsening of sleep apnea as well.
Can it run in the family?
It can run in the family. It runs in the family, and sometimes it's on the basis of weight. But also, the structure of your of the bones of the face and the muscles in the neck actually play a role as well. So sometimes we see people that are not obese but have that type of facial structure that allows for a smaller upper airway, and then it makes it easier to collapse and cause the sleep apnea events.
Yeah, recall the aftermath of the NJ Transit train crash. They were a good part of the conversation was the neck circumference of the engineer, which I found odd until I just recently read up more about sleep apnea. That is one of the not the warning signs, but just the alert that makes you aware that you might just be prone to something like this.
Sure. Yeah. When we ask primary physicians to screen for consideration, one of the things we look at is neck circumference. It's been found that a neck circumference greater than 16 inches is a risk factor, along with some of the other things like the body mass index, the weight, and the gender.
So as far as treatment is concerned, obviously if weight's one of the considerations or smoking, you can lose weight and stop smoking and lower your risk. But when someone is diagnosed with either obstructive or central sleep apnea, what are some of the actions that you would have to take as a physician?
Well, what we do to make the diagnosis formally is once we have a suspicion is we'll get what's called a sleep study or a polysomnogram. Nowadays, we have home-type tests where you can bring the device home, hook up a few simple monitors, and we can make the diagnosis that way. The traditional way is to come into a sleep lab where they spend the night under monitored conditions, and we can diagnose the sleep apnea by basically counting how many of these events they're having every hour. Once the diagnosis is made, you have to discuss with the patient the various ways to treat this. Of course, weight loss is very helpful, although it's difficult and it takes a long time to achieve effectively. So other things that we look at are something called CPAP, or continuous positive airway pressure. That's probably the gold standard treatment. And what that does is applies a pressure through a soft face mask into the airway, which essentially props the airway open so the patient can breathe continuously at night.
So it's a little more of an intense version of the nasal strips that we see over the counter.
Yeah, that's right. It's a way to effectively open the airway. There are other things as well. There are oral appliances, which is similar to a retainer that a kid might wear for straightening out the teeth. And what that does is it allows the lower jaw to be pulled forward just a few millimeters, and that's often enough to open up the airway and allow better sleep. So you have that option as well.
Is sleep apnea a permanent affliction once you're diagnosed? It's something you deal with, or is it something that you can overcome?
If it's weight-based, then certainly a loss of weight can cause tremendous improvement. I've had patients, for instance, that have had weight loss or bariatric surgery come back, get studied again, and they're found not to have sleep apnea. If it's based upon the facial structure, obviously without surgery, et cetera, that's harder to change and harder to affect a change in the sleep apnea in the long term.
Robbie, I'm talking to Dr. Douglas Frenia, who is the sleep specialist with the Center for Sleep and Breathing Disorders at St. Peter's University Hospital. stpetersuh.com, the website. Find out more about this and the other services that the hospital provides. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I was surprised, Doctor, that testing for sleep apnea was not part of the process for NJ Transit or really any of the railways and buses. I think CDL drivers have to go, I believe it's three-year testing for sleep apnea, but fortunately out of the tragedy might come something positive. It seems like this is going to be a new policy where train operators and other public transportation operators are going to have to be tested for this now.
Yeah, I think that's true. I see a lot of patients that are undergoing a routine physical for their commercial driver's license, whatever type of vehicle it may be, and they are usually flagged to be tested if they have certain features that we talked about, weight, also their snoring propensity and things like that. So we do see quite a lot of patients that are getting commercial driver's licenses, and there are laws in place to ensure the patient, if they have sleep apnea, that they get tested and they get treated effectively, and it has to be documented in the record so that they can work their transportation job.
We talk about this so often here on the show that there's symptoms and warning signs that we dismiss and with snoring maybe even laugh about. But as you heard Dr. Frenia describe, the body gives the warning signs for you to keep ahead of something happening. And so something bad does not happen, and certainly something The sooner you address it, the faster you can overcome it, and such is the case with sleep apnea. Learn more about this issue and the work of the Center for Sleep and Breathing Disorders at St. Peter's University Hospital. The website is stpetersuh.com, and we've been joined by one of their sleep specialists, Dr. Douglas Frenia. Doctor, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Chris.